Thank you.
Yeah, your trend is on.
I think it is.
Sorry.
I just want to go ahead and thank all of you for being here. You've braved some really difficult traffic and some really difficult weather to be here. And so I'm also delighted to know just before everyone arrived, I was able to go around the room and we have representatives from all of the different schools here, plus a number of people that are from who have just read about this this talk on the web and have come for their interest. So we have a very good crowd of people. So just to get you into the mood of things, to talking about monetizing digital innovation, why don't I start by asking you, what do you think about when you hear the word innovation? It would be just like a business school class. You here, what do you think of innovation? I know you're an HBSer. What word?
Look, Amy, you and I are both class of 81.
I know.
You have no idea?
Of course.
You
so is Pierre Philippe.
I was full of air. Philippe! No, no, I can't believe it. You recognize me? You got to be kidding.
So, I won't call on him.
This is trivial.
Okay, wait one sec. We have to get innovation. What are some of the words that come to mind for innovation?
For my personal experience?
Yeah.
Yeah, in my company that I have worked before, people keep saying innovation, but seldom do they really, really do it.
Okay.
It's a lot of company culture.
So you think of hype, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's not easy to say, but very difficult to do.
Ah, a very good point. Somebody else, what do you think of for innovation?
Well, it's like doing something for the first time that's never been done before like that. And, immediately apparent.
Okay, so something that's difficult to do, not immediately apparent. Lots of people want to do it, but can't really accomplish it. How about you? Innovation.
In terms of products or services.
Ah,
different types of innovation.
Different types of innovation, okay.
Models.
Business model innovation versus products and services. Somebody else from this side. What do you think? Innovation. What do you think of?
Something that not recognized by people in current time.
Okay.
Some creative ideas
that are not recognized in the time, but have some potential in the future.
Yeah.
So, how about some negatives about innovation? Does any negatives at all? This all sounds very positive. Besides not being able to execute, any negatives?
It costs a lot of money.
Costs money, might be very expensive. Okay, somebody else. Somebody has some negatives about innovation. Anything?
Losing jobs.
Might actually cause people to lose jobs. Interesting.
Yeah,
you have disruption.
Another issue is out of maybe one or two successful ventures, you have quite a few who don't.
Okay, so many people trying to innovate, but some of them failing. Right?
The race is a happy valley.
So, what about some others?
Could be stolen.
Oh, innovations could be stolen. Okay, you might put a lot of work into it, and then it could be stolen. All right, somebody all the way in the back, so you can I can be sure that you can hear me. Somebody all the way in the back. Innovation. What do you think of when you hear the word innovation? Take one.
Time consuming.
Disruptive. Okay, some negatives is disruptive. All right, let's think about that. So we have a lot of things in our head when we talk about innovation. Which one am I going to talk about first? I'm going to start by saying sometimes with industry analysis and strategy, we use the term innovation and we think about the Austrian economist who invented the word entrepreneurship, and he called it the creative winds of destruction, because he said every time you have something new, you have to get rid of the old. So there's the sense of, okay, it's good to have innovation, but it's disruptive. And maybe the people who were formerly leaders of an industry might end up being disrupted or become losers, right? So, for example, when we saw, when The Economist wrote about Skype and the web, what did they put down? They looked at the negative, dark side of innovation. They said how the internet, Skype, and free voice over IP killed the phone business, killed all of the telecom business. That was their view about Skype, right? So that view is one that's very much what we call a zero-sum game, right? You have a pie, and it has to be divided up. And the winners get more, and the losers get less, right? So this is, in the past, has been our view, is the dark side for industries, is that when there's innovation, sometimes there are losers. Someone who was an industry leader is no longer an industry leader, but loses out to something new, some new technology, right? However, what about innovation in this sense? What am I thinking of there? Why do I have this positive view of innovation here? Here's the Time magazine, and it says, best invention of 2007. What were they talking about? The iPhone. And Apple's creativity with the iPhone. But what else were they talking about? They're also talking about the App Store has reached 25 billion downloads. 25 billion downloads. Thanks, Apple, for giving all of us all of these different apps, right? So how many of you have an Apple iPhone? So about half. Maybe more. How about Android? Okay. Now, we have the question that I like for my class. How many of you have both? One for home. Your work gives you, has you have an Android, but you have one for home. So, we have a lot of experience with apps, don't we? We just look around and say, okay, how many apps, for example, do you have?
Me.
Yes, how many apps? Since you have both all together, how many on each of your?
Maybe very few. I would say maybe 15 to 20.
Only 15 to 20. Somebody else. Is this below average? Come on, tell me.
I think you underestimate the above apps. When I think I find that I don't run out of space, then I find out like 50 apps, and you didn't feel like you have 50 apps.
Right, so it's so easy to put on apps, right? That you can just put them on and forget that you have them until some point in time where you run out of space. Okay? How about somebody over here? How many apps do you have?
I have probably about 30.
30 apps. Okay. I think when we looked at our class, we had 50 to 70 young people kind of collect apps. Come sit down. I think there's one more chair right here. I know people were really, really hard-pressed to get here on time because of the weather.
See, come on in.
Is this part of the Yale Club?
Yes.
Yes.
This was the talk with the Yale Club. We have another Yalie here. Never fear. You are not alone. So, what's different about this view of innovation? Is this a zero-sum game? How many people know how much money was made by application developers and Apple in a few years' time? So just out of the blue with App Store.
Was it 5 billion?
Something like 2.5 billion in the first 2 years, and 5 billion, I think, in the next. So here we have a completely new market created, an ecosystem that's created out of innovation that benefited more than it took away, right? It created whole new marketplaces. Now, how much of that market were people who had not even participated before? How much do you think the developers, Angry Birds, people like that, how much do you think they made in terms of percentage for this being distributed 25 billion downloads? How much do you think? Okay, so the platform Apple takes 30%, right? So 70% of that revenue was shared by people who were software developers who came up with something new and then got distributed all over the world. So all these people who had never maybe participated in this kind of wealth became part of the Apple ecosystem. So it was more than our thought of how many of you know how win-win usually tends to be two circles that have a small intersection of positive mutual benefit. This is way beyond that, isn't it? Millions beyond that. Billions of dollars beyond that. Shared among how many developers who never before shared in this marketplace? Okay? So that's part of what happened, and it gives us a little bit of background that we all know about and we've all experienced to being able to say, what happened? How could we go from the internet killed the phone business to the web being the best innovation of 2007 and creating three or four new marketplaces with the iPad, the iPhone, with all of these things, and allowing all of these people who in the past had not participated in this marketplace to become part of the revenue sharing. Okay? Creating billion-dollar businesses within several years. Okay? So that's what we're going to talk about. That's the background. Looking at innovation, and in particular, looking at why the web has changed digital innovation. And why digital innovation is different than innovation with physical products and physical goods. Okay? So, to do that, this is a very busy slide, so I'm going to walk you through it. I have to mention these people, especially Oliver Williamson, because he was my Oros chair committee head. He is at Berkeley, and Oliver Williamson and Eleanor Ostrom in 2009 won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Does anyone know what Oliver Williamson's area of expertise was? Have you heard transaction costs? Okay. An easy way to think of transaction costs is that Oliver Williamson said, in the past, the coordination costs of managing anything, just being able to manage things, were very high. So it actually was easier to do something inside a company than it was to do it outside a company, right? Is that true now? Not always. Often it seems like transaction costs has made it really easy, right? And so the transaction costs have dropped dramatically because of digital goods and because of the web and communications. Okay? Eleanor Ostrom, on the other hand, did her Nobel Prize winning work in collective action. Because in the past, there was something called the tragedy of the commons. That if everybody grazed their sheep in a pasture that was common, it would destroy that good. It would destroy the pasture. And so a negative thing would happen, right? The same thing is true of traffic, let's say, as you may have experienced today. You may have experienced a lot of traffic. A network, like a physical network, when it gets too many cars and people on it, what happens? It gets congested, right? Negative effects. It turns out, in the web, you get positive effects. You may actually have a network that gets extremely, much, much better when more people participate in it. Right? So very different effect for digital goods and for the digital economy and the networked economy than what all of us are pretty used to, especially if you went to Harvard in 81. So What did network economics have to do with it? We'll talk a little bit about how the power of network economics multiply effects. We'll talk a little bit about how we now understand how information economics and big data make it possible for the wisdom of the crowd or crowdsourcing to become really effective. So all of these things together have changed the economics of business and collaboration and make something like the iPhone possible. And we'll talk a little bit more about how that works. So all of these are just some of the economics that we understand much more of now than we did before. Okay, how do I like to explain this? I like to explain the effect of the digital world and the knowledge economy as a global digital stone soup, where millions of cooks co-create value. So what do I mean by that? How many of you have heard of this fable of the stone soup? Good. Can you tell everyone? What is it about? What is the fable of the stone soup?
So these beggars go into a village, and they go around to different houses, and they're begging for food, but no one will give them any food. So they set up in the middle of the town square this large cauldron with some boiling water, and they put a stone in it. And soon all the villagers are coming out like, what's going on? And they're like, we're making soup, stone soup. And the villagers are like, oh wow, it looks so good. What do you mean you can make a soup out of stone? And they're like, yeah, but it would taste even better if you put a little bit of coriander in it, or a little bit of paprika, or if you just have a little scrap of meat, or this or that. So one by one, the villagers are like, oh, well, I have a little bit of that. So they go back into their homes, they come out, they pitch into the pot, and at the end of the evening, they have this wonderful soup or stew, and everybody gets to share.
Right. And it's a wonderful story of this village kind of, you know, at first not realizing that they're contributing to the well-being of all of the people in the village because they're able to enjoy the soup. Well, what's different about a digital stone soup? It's pretty important because in the soup story, in the fable, when you take soup from the pot and eat it, it's gone. So after the villagers are done, the pot is empty, right? There's no more stew. In a digital stone soup, on the other hand, digital goods being anything that in bit form, so music, software, photos that you've uploaded, videos that you've uploaded, all of these different things that are in bits, they all get added to the web, to the global digital stone soup. And when you take them out, do you actually deplete the soup? No, you don't. It stays there. It can be replicated almost costlessly. And you can decide to have only carrots or only something. You can slice and dice it in any way you want for your particular interest and make the software just the data that you want without depleting the soup. Okay? So here's a big difference with digital soup. All of a sudden, you have a situation where you can take something, slice and dice it, and unlike if I build a car, I have to sell it to one person. I can't sell it to two people. I could take this and I can slice and dice my digital carrot and sell it to you for $5. I can put it all together and sell it to you for $10. I can sell it to you for... And that's something where each of you might be very happy to pay a dynamic price or a different price for what you're getting because I've created the digital mix for you to be exactly what you want. And meanwhile, the soup remains undepleted. Knowledge is a non-depletable resource. Okay? So that's the difference of this global digital soup. Unlike the village stone soup that's eaten up, because of digital goods being able to be copied and also replicated and distributed like software for free, you have this huge resource that everyone contributes to. And if you can search for it, you can find something of interest that meets your interest or your price in some ways. So that's the difference of millions of cooks co-creating value. Unlike, I guess we have a saying, too many cooks spoil the broth, right? But that's physical goods again. So all of us, especially if you've gone to business school, have this view of the world being atoms, physical goods rather than digital goods, different economics, bricks, so capital expenditures, things that have infrastructure that get congested, versus clicks that essentially are kind of weightless and can be done it instantaneously, and there's another application. You know, you've got 50 now. Physical to digital and combinatorial, because you can slice and dice it in so many different ways to meet what you particularly want out of that digital soup. So that's the basis in some ways of why the economics of digital goods and information and network goods are very different. So, I know that in this group, there are probably a lot of bankers and investors or people in the financial area. So, I'm going to ask you to look at this. If this is on one side, dollars of return on the y-axis, and along here is time, what is this graph? What do we call that? You know, because you've been in my class. Whisper, what is it?
Cash flow.
It's a cash flow curve, return on investment. Now, if you knew that this was dollars on this y-axis, and this was negative here, loss, this was time, and you saw these three curves without my telling you they were Web 2, Web 1, and traditional, or physical, which of those three curves would you want to be on? The one that's growing very fast, right? Because that looks pretty good. And then, how do I get to a point where I could actually have, this is really odd, here's let's say a project, how can I actually have all positive? How is that possible? That I don't spend any money to get something going? And how many of you have done an important project? Did you have to spend money or invest money to it for a certain amount of time, right? What would be a good example? Everyone's nodding their heads. You know, what would be a sample project and how much you have to spend to get it going?
Digitalizing traditional media.
I'm sorry?
Digitalizing traditional media.
Okay. But what about something like in the physical world? What do you have to invest? Why do you have to invest before you can make money?
Real estate,
right? You might have to put a lot of money into developing a property before you can rent it out. You have to build it, right? So in a physical world, we're used to this curve where you put money in for a while, right? You burn up money for a while, and then after a while, you start getting income, and it goes positive. Right? So that's this traditional one is probably what we usually see for physical goods. Why would I call this one a Web 1? It goes really low down and then it goes up pretty fast.
Because you have to buy hardware and
servers. Ah,
and that stuff.
Good point. In Web 1, right, in the first web, you had to buy lots and lots of equipment, capital expenditures, right? And so, indeed, you had to pay a lot of money before you could start making money, right? Now, how could, can anyone guess, how could this in aggregate be positive, but it end up being just little small positive, negative, and then shoot up this way. Why would I say that the Web 2 return on investment cash flow curve could look like that? What has happened to our world of sort of digital goods?
Does it have to do with versioning?
Could be versioning, but what else?
Cloud computing.
Cloud. Here we hear the word. What? Why did cloud make a difference? Why?
You could pay for it as you use it.
Okay, how many people are familiar with the concept that cloud is now a bit like a utility? We're used to electricity, that we don't have to pay for a generator before we can get a lamp to work in our house, right? But we've been doing that for the longest time for IT, haven't we? We had to build our own generator before we could put a lamp on, right? Or put a stove on. But now, with cloud being like a utility, we can pay as we go. So we turn fixed upfront costs and capital expenditures in servers and whatnot into pay as you go just for what you use. Now, why would that be an advantage for small companies experimenting? Just like the electricity, you don't know if the weather's going to be very warm, you're going to have peak demand. You may not buy enough servers, right? And then you'd miss out on the uptake. Or you could be really wrong and nobody uses your service, and you bought all these servers and you're left with a lot of hardware and a lot of costs, right? So one of the reasons that you can do this, and in this book that I wrote, I use the example of Flickr. What Flickr did was it actually experimented with who was willing to pay revenue. And it turned out to be people who were willing to pay a monthly subscription because they were professional photographers. Then they discovered that some people wanted to have photos uploaded to nearby photo stores, and then they could get transaction fees from that. Then they discovered that a larger number of people might actually want to go to the places that were in the photos that were shared, and so they started to have advertising linked to, if you looked at a beach, there was a travel, you know, sort of paid search on best deals to that beach, right? So multiple streams of revenue that they discovered over time by essentially using using their customers as experiments. So very, very quickly responding to wherever there was uptake. And not in Flickr's case, but in many companies' cases now, they try it first as a cloud-based service so that they can go ahead and, if it goes really big, they've just made their capital, what would have been a capital expenditure, into an operational expense that's variable based on what they need and what they spent. Now, why is this curve so steep? That goes back to saying that one of the things that I won't talk too much about here is I talk about five kinds of network effects. And so network effects multiply. So if you can get 10 times the customer by using social media or by social marketing, 10 times the partners or developers, as in iPhone and Android, or 1,000 times the developers, and you can do it 10 times faster, you're starting to look at something that's multiplication or exponential, right? How does that change our thinking from old school, where we had to think about value added, right? We took the cost of the inputs and we added value to it to get to a price. Now all of a sudden, we've got multiplication and powers, exponential thinking, because of networks. So, the last thing I'm going to talk about is the secret of digital monetization. Because so much of this is based, as we were talking about, is based on delivering to the customer what they want. Actually, your revenue is connected to the user, is no longer connected to the physical good or the object. All right? So this actually is hard for us. We're used to, as business people, thinking about profitability being attached to an object, a good or service, right? That's how you get profit. You sell something, a good or product or service, and then you get a margin or something above, value added, above your costs. But wait a second. Once you freed yourself from the fact that each of these physical goods costs so much to create, now, all of a sudden, you have a situation where if you can lower the cost of acquiring a customer, so that's what CAC means, customer acquisition cost. How quickly can you generate or get users? And on the other side, how much can you monetize, or how much revenue per user can you make? So you want to lower your customer acquisition cost and then increase the revenue you make per user. All of a sudden, you have a very different situation and a different way of trying to value companies and projects than you did before. So, for example, now if you looked at a cost to acquire a company, you see, this is one of the reasons that you have so many companies that are what we call freemium or two-sided. How much do you pay for Google to search? Do you pay Google to search?
No.
No. You're a customer of Google, so you're a user. If I were to calculate the revenue per user for Google, I would count every one of you, right, as an active user. But where's the actual revenue coming from? From the advertiser, right? So here we have this strange situation where we have a two-sided or multi-sided network where the revenue is coming from an advertiser, but all of us get to use the service for free. How does that work? And why do they pay? Well, they pay because a Google advertiser could get something like a 7-time return on what they pay per click. So a pay-per-click dynamic pricing of billions of keyword auctions per week. So you have the winning combo of higher click-throughs and relevance for these Google advertisers. So these advertisers pay because every time they pay for a click, what are they getting? A new customer, right? 7 times the cost of the click. That's not bad, is it? So that's why if you were to look at revenue per unique user, Google has something like $24, even though it doesn't charge anything to you. That's what it gets from all of its auctions of keywords. Okay, yes?
Sure, I want to ask, does the buyer has to complete the transaction before Google?
No. The click is a pay-per-click. But they have a very, very clever way of keeping the most relevant of the advertisers, of paid search advertisers, at the top of the 11 top ranking. And they do that by only allowing that the ones who not only bid the highest, as we point out here, the page order is by price, so how much you bid. So let's say you bid $8, you bid $10, and you bid $7. Okay? So three people bid different things. But I'm not going to immediately just take your $10, because that's actually what Baidu does. It actually only takes the highest bidder. But is that really fair? Maybe your ads and your service isn't the one that people really want to click on. It's not well written, it might not be the most attractive, it might not be the most relevant. So the quality might not be as good. So I put in a quality score so that I can ensure the relevance. Plus, if it is more relevant, no doubt more people will click through. So it's a way of getting the most bang for each keyword and keeping people from just trying to raise the price out of and feel like they were paying far too much just to get to the top position. So the second price and quality makes a difference. Okay, who's monetizing network effects? In a paper I wrote recently, I said we need to think about a change in thinking. We know so much about competitive matrices and competitive innovation, disruptive innovation. But have we really thought very much about the collaborative innovation matrix? So I created one, and I put these four, 2x2, four boxes together. I said user to user, sometimes we call democratized innovation. And Wikipedia is a good example of democratized innovation. What's the disadvantage of democratized innovation? What is the major problem that Wikipedia has? It doesn't have a lot of revenue. It's a public good in some ways. Many people have contributed, but many people have benefited, but no monetization in some ways of those benefits. What might be a good example of company-to-user platform innovation? I'd say Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, probably a number of the social media sites in China. What about user-to-company crowdsourcing? This is where this little symbol here is the Smarter Planet, IBM's big venture. And they got there from crowdsourcing. They put together 25,000 of their managers plus huge what they called innovation jams, where they invited past customers, future customers, people who were interested in the area of how urbanization was going to affect the planet and environmentally. And they discovered that this was a theme that they could put a lot of the things they were working on together. Goldcorp is another good example of that, and if we have a few minutes, we may have a chance to look at that. This company-to-company is more recombinant innovation. So that's where Apple, Android, Amazon, Taobao, the new Apple in China, could be in terms of being a creating sort of this ecosystem and listening to customers about what they want. So I will go back and talk a little bit about Goldcorp, but I just wanted you to see if, based on what I said today, you were able to answer some of the questions that I had put in the abstract that drew you to this talk originally. What do you think? So what does the web, crowd, smartphone markets, social graphs, game theory, and big data have in common? We think about that. What are they? There are all kinds of groups that have network effects and are highly connected, right? So we need to think of them in a different way as a network, because they might multiply effects rather than add value, right? So what did IBM and Whirlpool do to spark innovation and entrepreneurship in their top 25,000 managers worldwide, resulting in several new $1 billion businesses in less than 3 years? So instead of the single innovator, we have crowdsourcing and the wisdom of the crowd that's made easier by this lowering of transaction costs so that more people can contribute to the digital stone soup and everybody can take more of what they need out of it, right? What business model is behind the profitability of LinkedIn, Facebook, GE, and Harrah's Casino Empire? A number of these things are looking at what you can do on your cash flow return on investment using Web 2.0 and big data to get to a better curve and a better, faster return and revenue per user than traditional ways. Now, did Google, eBay, United Sabre Systems, with for their plane reservations, or Bloomberg in financial systems, figure out the most effective dynamic pricing strategy generating the most auctions per day with the highest return? What do you think? It turns out to be Google. Billions of auctions. They're essentially auctioning off the English language and the locations of the world, right? And every one of those clicks is a revenue, but also a means to connect a user with what they're looking for, right? So actually, they're the ones with the most auctions per day with the highest returns. And how do companies big and small monetize their off-book digital capital? How would you assess your digital assets? What I'm suggesting is that try and think, if you're now measuring using profit and loss and you have a lot of customers, are you leaving those customers and their digital capital kind of unutilized and unleveraged? Is there some way that you could take your existing customers and not only bring them online, but offer them some kind of, you know, some sort of revenue per user service or monetization that makes them happy because they're getting what they want, whether it be a specific app or it be some information that they need when they need it for monetization? So I think one of the easy ways we've used this for companies as diverse as Telefonica, the phone company, and I think one of the ones that I'm proudest of is helping the Canadian Postal Service realize that they actually had digital, what I would call Rembrandts, in the attic. So Rembrandts are very expensive paintings, oil paintings, and sometimes there's the story that some person has it in their attic, underutilized, because they don't know the value of it. And so this is what happened with the Canadian Postal Service. They actually had all of something like, I think, between 5 and 14 million registered users for their online services. But they hadn't, but the board of directors and their senior executives hadn't figured out that they had to measure it in a different way. They were looking at it as saying, oh, well, that's not very much. That's not millions of stamps. But actually, stamps have a very low profitability and profit margin, while as their digital assets actually were something like 50 to 60% pure margin. So they needed to think of ways that they could increase the revenue and the monetization of each of their users. So for example, in Hong Kong Post Service, if I were to give you an app from the Hong Kong Postal Service that for a dollar would tell you whether your package was arriving today when you were going to be home, or you could click something and tell your postal carrier not to deliver it till tomorrow, Would you pay a dollar for that?
Yeah.
Yes, right? Can you believe that that not only is a dollar of revenue for each user and each package, but actually saves the post office something like $10 every undelivered package, because the amount of trouble they have to go through to get it redelivered and to store it actually costs them 10 times as much. So you could do something that not only made people really happy as a mobile app, get paid for doing that, but save $10 every time you didn't deliver a package on time. So those were the sort of things that we talked about that were so easy, that were digital kind of Rembrandts in their attic that would give them lots and lots of revenue with very little extra effort besides thinking in a digital way.